You're listening to Food Action in the Shoe Swap. I'm going to call it Food Action for short. This show is inspired by the Shoe Swap Food Action Co-op, a local organization of diverse individuals and groups dedicated to creating a model community where everyone has access to locally grown, healthy, affordable food. I am your host, Jerry Paquette, co-author of the book Eat to Save Your Life, and Director of Education with the Shoe Swap Food Action Co-op. Join me every week here on The Voice of the Shoe Swap as I bring in guests from various aspects of the food industry to explore the relationship between the food decisions you make and your ability to take charge yourself of health issues like diabetes type 2, inflammation, excess weight, cardiovascular problems, and a whole lot more, right? Yeah. My guests are nodding their heads. This is the radio, remember?
Yeah.
Today, I am keen to introduce you to someone I met at the Salmon Arm Eco Fair this past June the 4th, where CFAC was hosting a booth to welcome new members to its group of food-aware citizens. Across from SFAC's booth were two young people endeavoring to inform and educate people interested in the vegan diet and lifestyle. Joel, is that right, Joel? Just yep. Joel, isn't it?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, I asked you earlier, then I got it wrong. Joel LaFortune was one of those two people, and he is here with me today for a conversation all about veganism. He wrote me to say my friend Ellen Campbell is also coming. She is completing her master's in colonialism in environmental and animal liberation activism. Holy mackerel. You're going to talk about that, right, Ellen?
I hope so.
I think you'll find her work really interesting. And he is right. I'm already interested, and we expect you are too. So get your pens or pencils ready if you or someone you know is thinking about working on developing a diet using vegan principles and practices. Today's guests, Joel LaFortune and Ellen Campbell, are keen to share their thoughts and experiences about the vegan lifestyle. Welcome, Joel. Welcome, Ellen.
Hey, thanks for having us, Jerry.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm thrilled you're both here. And thank you, Joel, for inviting Ellen to come in. I think this is going to be a wonderful conversation. I'm keen. Let's get started. Joel, how did you get started in veganism? I'm assuming, of course, you're a vegan. You're the one who said, let's talk about this. So how did you come to be a vegan? It takes a bit of work, I think, doesn't it?
I'd say most of the work comes from learning, but once you get the hang of it, it's second nature. I wouldn't say it's any more work. I guess in terms of how I got started, I was about 19 or 20, and I was learning about the environmental impacts of meat and the health benefits, especially from an athletic perspective of a plant-based diet.
Were you an athlete? Were you competing?
Not competing. I just was climbing really hard.
Oh, okay. You're competing with the rock.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, competing with gravity. Yeah, still haven't beaten gravity though.
No, I guess not. But you've shown something to gravity who you are.
Yeah. I like to think so.
Okay.
So I was thinking about all these things, and I was having a conversation with my friend. We were coming back from a climbing trip in Squamish. She was sitting in the passenger seat, and his dog in front of him. And I was telling him about, how I was learning about the environmental impacts of meat. And, I'd seen a couple undercover videos of slaughterhouses and farming and also just learning about the health benefits of eating a plant-based diet. And I was telling him about this, and he said, even if it wasn't for all of those things, I would still be vegan. Mm. And I was really confused. And I looked at him and I said, what do you mean? Like, what else, what other possible reason is there?
Yeah.
And in a really, really kind of profound way, I still remember this experience very vividly. He says, look at this dog. And I look over at the dog, trying to keep my eye on the road as well. And, he's like, no, really look at this dog. And I'm like, okay. And getting a little bit intense, kind of. And I look, and this dog is looking back at me. And I really realized what he meant, and I can't remember the exact words he used, but he says something to the effect of, this dog's life is its own. It's someone having a unique experience of the universe and of life, and, you know, who the heck are you to take that away for just one moment of palate pleasure, for just for one moment of, like, you know, taste of bacon or something like who are you, who am I to make that decision about another creature? And and it was pretty, that was probably the big,
that was
big
profound
shift for
you, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. Especially, I mean, he was very clever. I'm not saying he's manipulating, but he's very clever using the dog as the way in, because we're so close to those animals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they're one of the few animals that we are close to in our very species-divided world.
So what was your next step then? I mean, you're now, he's got you thinking about it, reflecting. You didn't become a vegan at the end of the drive, but now you've got some things to figuratively chew on.
Yeah, absolutely. My next steps were probably about a six-month series of failures and learning how to eat properly. Because, I mean, I was a young adult and I, you know, had to learn how to cook. But then also had to learn how to cook cook vegan. And so I learned a lot, read a lot of cookbooks and kind of nutrition of just, you know, how to eat. And, you know, what I basically learned really was just, you know, a whole foods, plant-based diet. You know, eat fruits and veggies of all the different colors. And, you know, combining your beans and legumes and grains and nuts and stuff. But I got to say, like, I wasn't ever very smart about food as a teenager, so it was a big learning process for me. But
you were 20 at this time, so
21
in there somewhere. Yeah, so you're just bridging that whole history of not being too conscious of food and their types, and you didn't care about color one way or another. Suddenly, those things become important, but you're not sure quite how to combine
exactly.
them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was a big learning process for me, definitely. But once I kind of got the hang of it, it was. You know, it was pretty easy, and there's,
Okay, it's easy. I know a lot of people get it wrong, though. So, what are the cautions that you would share with our listeners about turning into vegans or turning to veganism?
You know, I think everybody's different, and they got to find what works for them. Some people, I've known some people that can, you know, just. You know, they make the connection and they can, you know, go cold turkey and they do it well and they do it healthily. A lot of other people, it's a real struggle. For me, it was a real struggle to learn how to do that. So I think just, you know, doing what works for you, finding recipes that you like, veganizing them. Like, I love lasagna. So I, you know, tried some different vegan lasagna recipes. I found the ones I liked.
Yeah, vegan lasagna always has hamburger in it.
No. Oh, that makes, doesn't it?
But that's probably where you were coming from, right? Because it did for you before that. So what did you replace that with?
My lasagna recipe? Oh, it's secret. I can't share that on the radio.
Hey, you're warming up to this. That's good.
No, I guess I just mean, you know, it's about, you know, just finding foods that you like. And, you know, because eating always should be...
But you said eating unhealthily or eating healthily. What's eating healthily? Well, let's put it the other way. What's eating unhealthy? How can a person who wants to switch over to vegan, how can they possibly go wrong with vegetables and legumes?
I guess for me, I just, you know, didn't know to eat a wide variety of them. Yeah, I guess I'm not really sure. I remember I made a lot of mistakes, though.
Well, I think there are a lot to make, and you're right. Eating diverse foods is important to the vegan in particular, and to all of us. But I think a lot of us, and you probably were this way as a teenager, you kind of ate the same diet over and over and over, maybe cycling it once a week or something, I don't know. But diversity is the big deal for all of us.
Yeah, you know, local beans, local grains, local veggies and fruit, like, and, you know, if you kind of get all those things, and, you know, you're pretty good, yeah.
Okay. Ellen, I've noticed you're nodding your head a couple of times there. Do you want to get in on this discussion about healthy versus unhealthy veganism?
Oh, for sure. When I first became a vegan, I wasn't aware of the sort of nutritional requirements that you really need, your body needs, because you're sort of brought up in a system where all of that is sort of prefigured out for you. Mm-hmm. You're kind of, when you go to school and you have the food pyramid, and that's kind of what's, you know, normal. Mm-hmm. And so when I became vegan, it was looking into what were the proteins that I needed? What were some complete proteins? What were some incomplete proteins? What kind of B12 did I need? And where did I need to get that B12 from? So it was looking at those particular things and trying to make sure that my diet was modified in a way that, you know, I was you know, taking care of my own health. As a teenager, I really... I was competing in marathons.
Oh, were you?
And I also wasn't feeding my body enough. I was kind of a borderline anorexic. And so as I sort of became vegan, health really became so important to me that I really wanted to be able to make sure that as my compassion developed, caring for myself also developed.
Your compassion developed. Compassion for what?
I think for animals.
Oh, okay.
But also for other humans that are caught up in the animal agricultural system.
Mm, like me.
It
probably
could be.
Yeah,
could
I mean, most people are not vegan. I think it's a small portion, relatively small portion of the population.
I think about 1%, and it seems to be doubling about every 5 years for the last.
Oh, is that right?
For the last couple decades.
Well, that's interesting, isn't
yeah.
it? So it's on the move. I mean, I very seldom run into young people who are vegans. It's usually older people who have gone through health issues, and they're kind of scrambling. But you're not scrambling, and you never were. But you made transitions in your life, and one of those transitional keys was the food you eat. Philosophically,
yeah.
Spiritually, can I say that?
Of course. Yes.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that for me for a minute or two?
Of course.
The spiritual side of food?
Mm-hmm. For me, I came to veganism. I was taking an animal ethics course at the University of British Columbia mm-hmm. with Professor Jody Castricano. And as part of that course, we read a number of articles, all philosophical arguments, coming at it from different perspectives. So there was a Christian perspective on veganism. There was an animal rights perspective on veganism. There was a sort of sentience or the capacity to feel pain perspective on veganism. And sort of decolonial perspectives on veganism and kind of put it into perspective for me that there were a number of different ways to approach the issue of animal use and exploitation and ways in which the way that we use animals is also in keeping with some of the ways that we also oppress humans.
Mm.
So looking at the ways that oppression manifests and is deployed against, you know, animals, human, non-human.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's a fine answer, and you slipped the word colonial in there, so I'm not going to get to that right now, but I'm very interested in getting to it soon here.
Of course.
What about your sense of the spiritual side of things, or philosophical? You don't have to go spiritual, but the abstract part of it.
Yeah, that's a difficult one for me to answer, because I don't really think very spiritually, I guess, or I guess not what I would call that
not formally anyway, not official.
Yeah. I guess for me it just comes down to you know, I don't want to, I guess, golden rule kind of, like, I think, you know, do unto others as they would do to you. I don't want to hurt anybody, and you know, if I can make choices that, you know, that don't hurt people, I can live happy and healthy with that. Like, why would I hurt people?
So there's a strong sense of values that go with this
yeah,
for
definitely.
You, whether you call it spiritual or philosophical, doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I guess.
Like
tying back to what my friend said, like, look at this dog. I mean, for me, I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, listening to the voices of people marginalized by our life choices, and people, and I'd also include animals because, you know, they're experiencing mm-hmm. the world too. Just listen to them, like, you know, listen to the sound that the mother calf makes to her, a mother and calf make to each other, and then, you know, listen to them when they're separated, listen to when the fish is being pulled out of the water, they're wiggling, they want to get back in the water. Like, you know, listen and look to what their experience is, and this, like, have a real, I think having a very deep sense of empathy is important. I think empathy is just my biggest value,
okay,
I guess.
That's the word, isn't it? It's empathy. That's what you're doing. That, I think your friend was very clever with the dog, because it's so easy to empathize with them. And of course, human beings empathize. And I think dogs empathize. I think other animals may or may not. I don't know about the worm, but, you know, yeah. I've got some birds in my backyard who seem to be in tune with me, you know, if I'm not with them. Have you come up against social issues with your determination to, as a teenager, you were not vegan, in your 20s you become vegan. Has that caused social stress for you at all?
Do you mean like social stress and like the, like, society of how I approach I approach and view the food system, or do you mean like socially amongst my friends?
Among your friends, your community, yeah.
I guess a little bit. I mean, I guess, yeah, seeing, it is hard, I guess, to, you know, go about in a world where, you know, you see all this animal suffering and then, you know, relating to people that are making these choices every day. So I'd have no idea how to make those compatible, but I guess I do, I kind of approach that question with kind of a different kind of paradigm shift. I think it's kind of interesting that you can, the way we define like people that don't eat animals as vegan, as like a separate group, or how, like, you know, no one that goes into migrant justice work becomes something else, but for animals, it's someone becomes a vegan. There's a certain, I'm not sure if I'm explaining that right, but becomes a something else.
Well, you get labeled.
Yeah, like it's a label, and
I guess that's what I was asking. Did your community label you and set you aside, or did you set yourself aside?
No, I certainly don't think that, you know, disengaging with the world is a good thing. I don't think that. I think it's always important to, you know, engage and, you know, always be friendly and stuff.
Well, you two certainly are that. But you've got a non-vegan sitting across from you here now. So
Totally. We're just humans. Yeah.
But I don't eat dogs. But I eat other animals. So what are your thoughts about, not so much our relationship, but people with whom you have relationships who do not share those views? Because veganism isn't just about the food you eat. It's about your way of looking at the world, and particularly at animals. And not everybody shares that view. Only, over 90% of people don't. So how do you perceive others who are not vegan? Let's just flip that around a little bit.
What do you think, Ellen?
Well done.
Just passing the bag. For me, perceiving my perception of people who aren't vegan yet, and when I was...
What did you say, vegan yet?
Vegan yet, yeah, I did say that.
That was good. You thought you said that through, didn't you?
Right. I guess... maybe veganism, you know, it's something that I think when I became vegan, right before I became vegan, I still didn't really fully capture and understand really the choice that I was about to make. And when I'd been speaking to vegans before I became vegan, I had a range of different perspectives on you know, why they became vegan. And
how old were you when you made your change? Joel was about 20.
I was 21.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so about the same.
Still
for
about
both
the same age.
Okay.
Sometimes I'd be speaking to vegans and they would be very accepting, and they'd, you know, be incredibly empathetic, because I mean, being vegan is about empathy towards everyone, whether or not they agree with you or not.
Yeah, totally.
And then sometimes I would have vegans that were a little bit more militaristic maybe in their stance. And I always felt that the vegans who approached me with empathy, I always was so much more open to what they had to say, and really, really started to experience, you know, if I ever became vegan, what I would want to be like ideally.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
I think with empathy is the biggest. I think empathy is maybe our word for the day.
Well, it's a powerful. I think it's more than a human characteristic, but certainly we're responsible to be able to empathize. We talk about sympathy a lot. Empathy is much more powerful. Sympathy is pushing someone away. Empathy is bringing someone in.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I'm going to just take a little break here right now. And then, if I may, I'd like to read from some documents on veganism from Wikipedia, because I think it's full of some interesting things that we may want to comment on. And make sure before the show goes that you talk a little bit about some recipes that you like. And I really want to get in a discussion with you, at least for a couple of minutes, about proteins and enzymes. Are you prepared to do that?
A little bit, I can.
Okay, well, we'll explore it a bit, because I think that for me is from, you know, I've watched a lot of people try to adopt veganism, and it's the proteins that let them down. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't mind talking about that, because there may be people listening here today who are thinking about this, and I think they ought to know what the dangers are. I think in your case, Joel, you experimented a lot and were in tune with your own body, I suspect, and you arrived at the right blends of foods. I'm glad you talked about colors. That's very profound, and we'll talk about why later. So let's do that. I'll take a break, and then I'll go over to Wikipedia, and I'll come back to you, okay?
Awesome.
You can take a break and relax for just a second. I want to remind everybody that they are listening to CKVS 93.7 FM, and you're listening to the show Food Action in the Shoe Swap with your host, myself, Jerry Paquette. We're sponsored by DeMille's Farm Market. Without them, we're not on the air, and our other sponsors as well. DeMille's offers a wide selection of fresh quality fruit and produce from the local Shoe Swap area, as well as from around the world. DeMille's is open 7 days a week from sunrise to sunset and has been open since 1970. For more information, visit DeMille's website at demillesfarmmarket.com or by calling directly at 250-832-7550. And while I'm talking about that, and we're having a conversation about food here, I want to remind you all that the Shoe Swap Food Action Co-op is hosting a series of Shoe Swap Food Conversations, the dream child of Mr. Ron Burr, co-director with me of education in Shoe Swap Food Action, and he has devised this scheme of conversations. And Ellen and Joel, if you are free, they are on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock at Okanagan College. We've had our first one last week, and this week's the topic is, what the heck are we eating? I threw in the heck. What are we eating? What's in our food beside food? Clean foods versus dirty foods, local versus import, food labeling, safety, quality, and contaminants. Dr. Warren Bell will be the first speaker. He is a physician, a local physician, and an environmental activist. And also Andrea Gunner, BC Institute of Agrologists and a food activist. So we've got activists here today, too, with us. We're going to talk to Ellen a little bit further about her degree and her activism. Right now, I want to just provide us some formal context for veganism. I want to read you some discussions on Wikipedia about this. This is interesting. The term vegan was coined in 1944. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Well, there you go. You learn something every day on Voice of the Shoe Swap.
For
the term vegan was coined in 1944 by Donald Watson when he co-founded the Vegan Society in England. At first, this meant non-dairy vegetarian, and later, the doctrine that man should live without exploiting animals. Interest in veganism increased in the 2010s. More vegan shops opened, and vegan options became increasingly available in more supermarkets and restaurants in many countries. Vegan diets tend to be higher in dietary fiber, magnesium, folic acid, vitamin C, vitamin E, iron, and phytochemicals, which we could have a whole program about, just phytochemicals. Thousands of them, and we haven't even named them yet. You know where you find them? In the colors and foods. And that's why I got excited about colors of foods when cool. you mentioned it. Vitamin D, calcium, zinc, and B12. You talked about big B12, and we'll come back to that. Well-planned vegan diets can reduce the risk of some types of chronic disease, including heart disease. So people should be listening up, don't you think?
Definitely.
Vegan diets are regarded as appropriate for all stages of the life cycle by the American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the Australian National Health and Medical Research Council, and Dietitians of Canada. Let me move on here because there's some really fascinating stuff. And the language is really fun to play with. Here we go. The origin of the English term vegetarian, we'll go back to that, because people can be vegetarians without being vegans, right? But the word vegetarian has a long history. The earliest known use is attributed to the actress Fanny Kemble, writing around 1839 in Georgia in the United States. The practice can be traced to Pythagoras in the 6th century BCE in Greece. Greek philosophers Empedocles and Theophrastus were vegetarians, as were Seneca the Younger, Ovid, Plutarch, Plotinus, Porphyry, and the Arab poet Al-Ma'ari. I don't know some of those. Some of them I do know. Their arguments were based on health, the transmigration of souls. How's that? The animal welfare, as you've already talked about, and the view espoused by Porphyry in his book on paper in those days called On Abstinence from Animal Food, that if humans deserve justice, so do non-humans. And that was the basis of it. Now, that's a long time ago. So what you're involved in has a really long history.
Yeah, and I'd even say that there's even more than that that goes beyond the Western kind of tradition. Like, there's certain Buddhist sects and groups in India that have been practicing plant-based eating.
Eurocentric, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. For a very, very long time. Probably even longer than that, too.
But yeah, I've got some even earlier dates here as it goes on. And we talk here, or they talk about well-known British novelists and so on and so forth. But it is Eurocentric. So thank you for pointing that one out. Let's go to activism, all right? Because there are strong feelings about all of this stuff. And where there are strong feelings, there's going to be political will. So let's talk about your thesis and what kind of an activist you are and how that manifests itself. Give us your title again.
Of course. So right now I'm Ellen Campbell. I'm doing my master's thesis at UBC Okanagan. My supervisor is Jody Castricano, who's sort of very well known.
Dr. Jody
Castricano.
Castricano.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
My master's thesis started when I went out on a Sea Shepherd campaign. And Sea Shepherd was founded in the 1980s by Captain Paul Watson. And I heard about this campaign in the Faroe Islands, which is a small archipelago of islands in the North Atlantic. And I went on this campaign, and I sort of saw the ways that Sea Shepherd was working to defend the whales, because there's a sort of whale slaughter that happens up there called the Grindadrap. And
say that again, called the what?
The Grindadrap.
The Grinda?
Grindadrap. Grindadrap. I think that's how I...
okay.
It's hard to spell it out without
That name before. I certainly know about the slaughtering of the whales and the other things you talked about, but not that name. So say it one more time for us.
Grindadrap.
Okay.
And for short, it's also called Grind. It's it has been compared to other whale and dolphin slaughtering practices. People have compared it to Tai Chi, if you've watched the documentary The Cove. There's also multiple documentaries that are out on online as well that'll teach you a little bit about the Grinta Trap if you're interested, that are produced by local Faroese activists.
Faroese,
from the Faroe Islands.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Thank you. That's okay. I mean, you've been steeped in a master's degree, so I forgive you. I'll just correct, you know,
your
assumption that we understand. So
course.
Go on with this. This is very good.
So as I was working with Sea Shepherd, a lot of individuals were launching complaints. The sort of activism that Sea Shepherd was doing was participating in eco-colonialism or neo-colonialism, or simply just imperialism or colonialism, in that a large group of people, the majority of them white, and the majority of them English-speaking, from the United States, England, France, were coming to a country and telling people what they could and could not eat. And on top of that, Sea Shepherd was coming in and sometimes saying, "Oh, I think you should eat your vegetables." And that's a quote from Pamela Anderson when she came to the islands. And when that was happening, they were saying, "Well, we don't have vegetables here. We're a small rocky archipelago. Yeah. We don't have vegetables. We have lamb, which we raise here, and we have the whales." And any vegetables that we have, generally we have to import them. And so are you telling us that we should import more vegetables or import more beef so that we can survive up here? And so I started to see the ways that Sea Shepherd's approach to broaching the question of what it was to live ethically was actually sometimes it could be construed as being counterproductive, and so a number of Faroese activists and whalers, doctors alike, the chief medical officer in the Faroe Islands, for example, also kind of had this feeling that the campaign was counterproductive. And you can also see the number of people, especially young people, who were signing up to be part of the Grinta Trap actually increased, people have argued, as a result of Sea Shepherd's campaigns and activism there. And so that kind of gave me pause to reflect on what does it really mean to be advocating for animals, and what will be effective in the long term. And I continued through with that question. I went on another campaign with Sea Shepherd on Operation Hyro, which is down in Costa Rica.
There'll be a lot of people listening who are very envious of your time on Sea Shepherd.
It was quite amazing and a huge learning experience.
When was that, Ellen?
This last past summer.
Oh, so you're still really
very recent.
Fired
still
up about
sort of,
it, yeah.
So still sort of reeling a little bit.
Are you getting burned from the enthusiasm over there, Joel?
That's awesome, yeah.
This is good. Go on. I'm just,
okay,
just having
sure.
fun with you.
As part of my work, I went down there, and we were on this beach called Moin, and Moin has a sort of criminal aspect to Moin. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of drug trafficking that happens there, and there's a lot of turtle poaching, and crime sort of follows that. And so there was a young Costa Rican activist named Jairo Mora Sandoval, and he was murdered on the beach, along with a number of volunteers who were raped as a result of their conservation efforts. And so Sea Shepherd was kind of going down there to try to help this situation and to try to protect these turtles who were left unprotected.
Who was in charge of the Sea Shepherd? What group founded that, I guess, is the...
Good question. So Captain Paul Watson, who's from Vancouver, he sort of started Sea Shepherd. He founded Sea Shepherd after leaving Greenpeace. And
okay, that's what I was looking for.
Yes, of course.
His journey. Yeah.
Yes, of course. And he was looking for an organization that would affect change more so, and I believe this to be true, more so through an enforcement aspect. Mm. And so a lot of basically what my thesis talks about is that which is called direct enforcement. So direct action is something we all kind of know about, is you go out into the streets and you do something. Mm. Direct enforcement is going out in the streets and enforcing a law.
Mm.
And so I look at the sort of colonial implications of that. So if Sea Shepherd is going down into Costa Rica and enforcing an international law or a national law, what are the colonial implications of them coming down and doing that, rather than, you know, holding up and supporting and being allies with local activists who are already doing that work?
Which is the way I take it you would prefer things happen.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's been sort of analyzed as a way that can be very, very effective in working with communities.
So describe your activism then. Have you become active as an activist? You're in the writing stage. You're just finishing off your master's degree, and I know that's a haul, and you're focused on that. But have you become politically active over these issues? And if so, how?
I think our experience over the last couple of days can maybe speak to that a little bit.
Yeah.
Joel, do you want to speak a little bit about what we've been doing over the past couple of days?
Sure. I guess it's a little bit unrelated, but well, still pretty related, yeah. Over the past couple of days, we've been going up to Rudock Creek, up near Tum Tum Lake, which flows into the Adams Lake and into the Shuswap Lake. There is a mine being proposed up there called Rudock Creek, which would be operated by Imperial Metals, which is the same company that caused the Mount Pauley disaster.
Mm.
For those of you who don't know, Mount Pauley was the worst mining disaster in Canadian history. It happened in 2014, where a tailings dam breached and released thousands of kilos and tons of toxic chemicals like arsenic, mercury, and lead into Quesnel Lake, and they haven't been held responsible, and they continue to try and operate with a business as usual approach, even though the indigenous communities there have not given consent. And also the Rudock Creek, there's been a very clear declaration of saying no, that, you know, the Squatmuck do not consent to this mine. Chief Judy had and along with their elders had a declaration against this proposed Rudock Creek mine, and yet Rudock Creek is trying to go ahead. So for the last couple of days, we've been we went up there and took some video of the area and interviewed a few elders from the community, and we're just trying to really raise awareness about this continued form of colonialism, which is, you know, absolutely devastating to the earth. And you know, everybody living around here, you know, we all share the Shuswap Lake, and it's, you know, I can't imagine what would happen if another Mount Pauley happened right here in our backyard, and I really want to stop that and stand in solidarity with the people that are working to stop that, whose territories that we're on.
Hmm.
Yeah, so we've been pretty busy with that. It's a pretty big drive up there.
What have you been doing specifically? And thank you for your summary. That was very well done.
Oh,
What are you doing then? You're up there. You're making some video footage. Are we going to see any of that?
So as my work with Sea Shepherd was, I was mainly on the media crew, so I was making a lot of, I was helping to film a documentary, which is upcoming, called Why Just One with Sea Shepherd. And so with that experience, I was able to use that sort of video knowledge, and we're making sort of a short documentary about the activism that's been ongoing for years in this area to protect the sacred land, and sort of work in allyship with the communities that have already been working, and to help support them in their work, because if we're ever going to be effective at helping to protect humans and non-humans, this is one of the ways that you can do that and be incredibly effective.
Okay. All right. Wow. Well, congratulations to the two of you, and what an adventure this must be for you.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area up there near Tum Tum Lake.
I've never been up there, but I can certainly say, yeah, I imagine it is. So this is your first time up there, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what exactly prompted you to suddenly make this trip?
I really don't want another Mount Pauli to happen, and I think it's disgusting the way the Canadian government and corporations are continuing to disrespect Indigenous communities. I'm sick of corporations thinking that they can, you know, destroy all this land and cause all this pollution and get away with it.
Well, you know, I've got to congratulate you on something that I think is really significant. As you're talking to me, you each have developed a strong sense of values out of your concern for food and other things, the animals, etc. A lot of people do that, but very few people fully commit to it. And I think what you described there is the description of a commitment to a set of values. As soon as you commit, you're active. You're on the road. You're taking part in something, and you've made the commitment. Not everybody does that.
Well, if anybody else wants to make the commitment and keep, not that we're doing lots of stuff, but like if anybody else wants to get involved, check out the Facebook page, Imperial No More.
Imperial No More.
Yeah, it's a campaign spearheaded by the Suquamish Women's Warrior Society.
Okay.
To shut down Imperial Metals and their mm-hmm. operations in the unceded territories here. And also there's a GoFundMe for people to donate to.
Okay, so...
Yeah, there's another really great Facebook page for other land-related issues called In Solidarity with All Land Defenders.
Hmm.
I'll say that again really slowly. In Solidarity with All Land Defenders.
Okay.
They post a lot about land issues going on in BC and how to get involved and how to support Indigenous communities.
Excellent.
Fighting against exploitative resource extraction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All of this from veganism.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, you're working with the First Nations groups when you do this. And most First Nations people are certainly not vegans. And yet they
I've met a few. You're right.
I think probably just statistically. But
of course,
Their described relationship with the animal world is very strong, and it's always seemed both pure and noble to me. They have a spiritual connection with the animals that they eat, especially the fish, the salmon here in this area. Very, very strong affinity for them.
Yeah.
Now that differs from the vegan. You wouldn't eat them at all. But what are your thoughts mm-hmm. about their particular relationship with the animal world, where they do eat them,
yeah.
but they respect them, value them, worship them?
I think that's a really great question. For me, I guess, as much as I, you know, don't want to see animals suffer or die for anything, I also do not want to perpetuate colonialism. So even if I don't agree or anything, it's recognizing that I don't have, as a settler here, I don't have any authority to tell people what to do, and that and also just recognizing that my support for Indigenous struggles isn't conditional on people living a certain way or not.
Really following the tenets of anti-colonialism personally.
I try to. No, I don't think anyone's ever perfect at it, but you know, it's always a learning process. I try to, but I think this is Ellen's thing, so she's...
How did you come to it, though? Through Ellen, maybe? Has Ellen helped you understand colonialism because she's formally studying it, or how did you come to it yourself?
I don't like to complain, but I guess I got really disillusioned with the environmental movement. Was really trying to be active in environmental issues, and then one day I saw this poster for an event in Vancouver called Land Defenders Speak, and on the panel was Frida and Togestai from Unistoten, Kanhus Manuel from here in Iskolnith, and another woman named Sashim from Ahauzit. And hearing them speak about how they've been protecting the land and their area was just really inspiring. And I guess from a really practical point of view, they were way better at it than these environmental organizations. And it just kind of really made me think that, you know, there's all these environmental organizations getting, you know, millions of dollars, and, you know, they go buy polar bear suits and get petitions, and, you know, by and large, I feel like don't do as much as they could with all that money. And yet there's the most marginalized communities in the world, like indigenous communities, often are really saving areas. You're doing with very little resources, and also very little respect from the larger environmental community. Like, I mean, you can bring up examples of what happened in the Great Bear Rainforest with the logging companies, and how the indigenous community, with all these protests, and then it eventually resulted in a meeting, and then the indigenous communities in that area were totally left out of the meetings, whereas in the meeting was the logging companies, the government, and the large environmental organizations. And I think that's just, I think that's whole way of going about environmental activism really needs to just end, shift to supporting indigenous communities and taking the cue from them of how to protect the land.
And your head is bouncing and nodding, Alan. You agree with Joel and what he's saying here?
Oh, certainly. I think the numbers really show you what's effective and what's ineffective. Campaigns that have by and large ignored local communities, that have ignored indigenous movements, are almost always on the whole less effective. That's what I found through my research. And so I think even on terms of effectiveness, if that's how we need to approach NGOs and say non-governmental organizations and say it's not going to be effective if you don't include local community members, then that's one way we can do it. But it's also just a matter of doing what's right.
Yes, that's the right thing to do.
And participating in, you know, anti-colonial struggles, anti-racist struggles.
I have met, I spent 50 years as a professor teacher, so I've worked with people roughly your age all my career. And it's been several years now since I retired. I'm still speaking to some of those people. They're still around. God bless Facebook. You know, most of us who retire lose track of our students and vice versa. But Facebook is keeping me in touch with many of them. And many of them are doing what you're doing. We're this show, the Voice of the Shoe Swap, is inspired by the Shoe Swap Food Action. Mm-hmm. And Shoe Swap Food Action is also very highly motivated and inspired by, motivated to support young people in staying on the land because they're leaving, and the land, the small pockets of land, are being turned over to large farming corporations because the young people are leaving. But I'm seeing a change. I mean, if your voices and the values that you're espousing here today and reflecting here today are more common than we know among people roughly your age, we're in good hands. You know, this is very inspiring. I've had several young folk about your age who are living on farms, like out at Cranogale, and some more are coming. Next week, Michelle Susumi is coming in, and she is, do you know her?
No, I don't.
Oh, write this name down. It's TSUMI. And she is one of the leaders of the Young Agrarians.
Okay.
And they've got an event coming up that I encourage you to go to. Listen to the show next week.
All right.
She'll be here with a young person about your age again who is an outstanding beekeeper. And I'm just finding people such as yourselves who are young, who have developed a remarkable value system, I think. I don't think you learned this in school from the curriculum so much as from some other source. We might explore that on another show. But there are an awful lot of you out and around, and I'm glad to get some of you into the studio like this just to hear your voice. I'm very moved, and I suspect a lot of our listeners are too.
Thank you. Another thing I think is really important with in terms of talking about veganism and indigenous solidarity is that veganism uses way less land than a diet that includes meat. Take grass-fed beef, for example. People tout it as a environmental choice, but really that's 50, you know, the numbers vary where depending on where you are, but roughly about 50 acres that no bear, no deer, no wolf, or like, you know, that area is 50 acres for a cow, whereas you can produce that same amount of protein, like that would be animal flesh, like you can produce that same amount of protein in plants like beans and grains in roughly about a tenth, depending on what beans and grains you're talking about, and get complete proteins in about a tenth of the land. So, you know, when we consider that, you know, we're living on stolen land, and I think we should try and use less land. And I was out hiking up under big cliffs, and I just kind of had this thought of, wow, like this is such an amazing pristine it's such an amazing value
rich
valley. And it's all farmland and cows and farms and you know, there's with the Hulk Hair you know, the dairy farm they're spilling into the watershed there. How amazing would it be if, you know, we could use a tenth of that land, or, you know, however much it was, but way less, like, land would be turned back to natural forests, which would be, you know, carbon sinks, and instead of producing so much methane.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to, the hour's almost up. Didn't I tell you it was going to come upon us? You know, it really has, and we've got lots more to talk about, and I'm going to have some other people in the show talking about it, and you are welcome to come back, and you're welcome to phone in, and you're welcome to do all those things. And I would encourage you to consider joining the Shoe Swap Food Action Co-op, because...
I think I already joined, yeah.
You already joined?
I paid $5 on a website somewhere.
Did you?
I think I get emails.
Oh, do you? Well, I'll look you up, because I'm the one who does the emails, but I do it, you know, holistically. Here's the music. It's
so
coming
much.
On. I want to thank the two of you so very, very much for coming in. I know you're awfully busy. I love your passion and enthusiasm. And I want to remind everybody here that they are listening to Food Action in the Shoe Swap with Jerry Paquette and his guests Joel LaFortune and Ellen Campbell, and who shared their thoughts and their values and their spiritual predilections with us today, and I think we're going to have them back. This show is brought to you by DeMille's Farm Market, who, as you know, carry a fine selection of specialty products from local producers and really support local producers right here in the Shoe Swap, which is part of what the two of you talked about today. Local, local, local. Because then you can care, in part. All right, thank you very much for coming in, everybody, and thank you all for listening. See you next Monday when my host or my guest will be Michelle Susumi. So thank you, and goodbye.
Thank you.